The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 50 is Anton Barbeau. He's from California. He's been putting out albums since 1993. His career really kicked off with 2002's King of Missouri. You are right now listening to the title track of that, credit to Anton Barbeau and the Bevis Frond. He's got something over 25 albums. He will be talking about High Noon from his most recent Magic Act, 2016, then going to Dust Beneath My Wings, which he put out under the name 3 Minute Tease. That was a trio that featured Morris Windsor and Andy Metcalf, better known as The Egyptians, as in Robin Hitchcock and The Egyptians. That was from the album called 3 Minute Tease from 2011. But that song has been remade a couple times, so we'll even play a little bits of other versions, including one he produced for Allison Seconds. For a third song, we'll look back to 2016's In the Village of the Apple Sun, which is the title track of that album. We'll conclude by returning to Magic Act for a tune called Swindon that features XTC's Colin Moulding. And as I said, though Anton is from California, he did emigrate to England and shares a lot in common with those eccentric English songwriters like Robin Hitchcock, XTC, Julian Cope. A very interesting voice, one I had not been familiar with before this interview. You can learn more about him at AntonBarbeau.com. And to learn more about this podcast, check out NakedlyExaminedMusic.com. You can support our efforts by going to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will have played, to kick things off, a little bit of the King of Missouri track, just to show something from your golden age, your younger period. Not that young. You know, it seems like you had all these albums, some of which I have not heard, from the 90s, and this seemed some sort of breakthrough. Or is it just because you were doing it with the Bevis Frond that they were an established?
That record did serve me well in the sense that it pushed my music into the ears of a sort of a new audience. The Bevis Frond are a wonderful rocking band of I want to call them freaks, but they're not. They're very reasonable people. And they've got a very loyal fan base. And King of Missouri originally came out on their label on Woronzo. And so all the Woronzo people picked it up and, you know, that helped a little bit.
I guess I should not be calling a British band Bevis. They would probably not appreciate that.
It's a pretty understandable and familiar mistake with that band's name.
So moving from that to sort of the most obvious trend in the catalog as I was listening through is, okay, we've got more rockin' jangle stuff at the beginning, and then it gets more synthy, more psychedelic, and that's a not atypical trend, but then first you show me something from 1985, so you were doing synth stuff right at the beginning, and then the first song we're actually going to talk about here, High Noon, this is a, you know, XTC style, straight up jangle, I don't know if it's jangle, I mean, it's got a riff, it's not a acoustic strum throughout, but it's a power pop song of sorts.
High Noon was originally written for a project called the Acoustic Guitar Project. And I think it was something like, in various cities around the world, an acoustic guitar is delivered to some head songwriter type. And this person passes the guitar along. Whoever gets the guitar is also given a little handheld recorder, tape recorder. And your assignment is to write a song on this particular guitar and record it on this particular tape recorder. And then you pass the guitar and the tape recorder along to the next songwriter in town. And this was going on in cities around the world, the Acoustic Guitar Project, it was called. And so I did my bit in Berlin, was given this guitar, and I was writing for an assignment, you know. And so for when I'm doing something like that, I suppose it's easier if I'm given parameters and said, you know, I need you to write this kind of song in this much time. I can say, all right, fine. And so in this case, I just thought, I'm just going to write, I suppose, the most Anton song I can come up with. It's going to be in the key of G because I always write in G. It's going to have all the little tricks that I would expect of myself. And I felt no qualms about this. I, you know, sort of ripping off my best and worst cliches and shoving them into a sort of 3 minute style pop song. So it probably took me 2 or 3 hours to write the thing, and it was done. And that was satisfying in its own right. And I just didn't really think much of it. but the melody kind of jumped back into my head a few days later, and I thought, oh, that's kind of catchy. And the song grew on me. I didn't like it at first. I felt that it was just a bit of hack work, you know, but yeah, it grew on me and I became fond of it and somehow sort of took another look at the lyrics and thought, oh, they're sort of meaningful somehow. It sort of feels like my own mother is in the spirit of the song, and that's kind of a nice touch.
How many years back was this project? Was that still recent?
Magic Act came out last year, and I think High Noon may have come from just the year before. So it's a pretty contemporary song, one of the newer songs from the Magic Act album.
Yeah, so say a little about the album as a whole, what you were trying to do with that project.
It was meant to be the third album with my then band, 3 Minute Tease, but the band came apart before we made the third album. I was making my plans for the album. I had songs written, and when the band kind of fell apart, I was left with half an album started and I wasn't sure what to do with this. I realized, well, I guess it's a solo record. And I asked a few people if they wanted to play on the record. And it became one of those, hey, everybody, you know, be on my album kind of situations. And thankfully, both Andy and Morris, who were in 3 Minute Tease with me, are all over the album. Everybody's on the record. So I'm happy with that. But it did lead to, we're talking about High Noon, and that song features Colin Moulding from XTC on bass. I suppose that wouldn't have happened if it had been a 3 Minute Tease record. So for me, it's a really interesting record. It's a record that kind of created itself. You know, I don't want to be boring about it, but it's sort of, it has a story. And the story is this band falling apart and the album kind of saying, well, I'm still here. What are you going to do about it? And it allowed me to sort of look through my collection of other songs, and I grabbed a few older things. Like there's a song called Swindon on there, and I was able to dust that one off and get Morris to play drums on there, and I think Carla and Coy from the Corner Laughers are on there, and various people on various songs, kind of adding to the mix. And somewhere in all that, the album kind of glued itself together. And the title Magic Act references my early days as a performer. I started off as a magician. I did a little magic act as a kid. And from there, I got into acting because I wanted to there's a slip for you. You can edit that or keep that. I wanted to meet Tracy Partridge from the Partridge Family. When I was a kid, I wanted to meet her. So I thought, well, I'll be an actor. And so I tried my hand, or I probably tried both hands at acting, and wasn't very good. My first role was as Jesus, though, in the school play. That was, you know, start big and work your way down. I started playing keyboard somewhere around that time as well. And just, I realized music was the thing. Acting was not what the world wanted from me. But anyway, the album title, Magic Act, kind of references, I suppose, my destiny as a performer. You know, one way or another, I was going to be on a stage somehow.
Son of God, record in the charts, a human cannonball. Born of virgin blood, your mama paid the price, her back against the wall. And so they shot her into space, said stick this flag into the moon. High Noon, the sun reflected on its satellite. Affected you, your appetite. Son of Dracula, I've seen the script, I know the makeup man. There's rats and bats and stuff inside the crypt, inside the cleanup van. And with the stake right through the heart, to burst a bright red blood balloon. High Noon, the sun reflected on its satellite. High Noon, has death affected you, your appetite? Don't pretend you don't know what I'm on about. Tell you it's the end, so pull your feet. son of mom. Record in the charts, a human cannonball. Love, there's only love. Your mama paid the price, her back against the wall. And as they spat into her face, as though she were a brass bit too, the tears that fell were full of grace. And Mary sang this very tune. I knew the sun reflected on its satellite. I knew, has death affected you, your appetite? Each day is longer than the one before. I knew cockroaches dancing on the kitchen floor.
Yeah. So for High Noon here, I mean, you've got, even though this is something that you said is coherent as a solo acoustic guitar song, it's pretty splashy. You've got some cool little lead things. You've got some little just synth stuff creeping in here and there. Is that just the way you record now at this point, as opposed to, I saw some of a live gig where everything is much more rock based and you've got a lead guitarist covering those parts, but really it's the energy pushing it forward. Whereas it seems, especially with an album like this, a song like this, that it's the little touches, the little synth coming in for one little bit, the goofy dissonant piano that comes in for a few measures and goes away, things like that.
I think the thing is that I love sound as much as I love songs. And I wonder if this is sometimes to my detriment, but I'm kind of obsessed with the sound of things, you know. And, you know, while we're chatting, I'm surrounded by synths at the moment. And you talk about the origins of the song High Noon as, you know, something for this acoustic guitar project.
Son of God, record in the charts, a human cannonball.
And I do a lot of gigs solo acoustic, you know, acoustic guitar or piano or what have you. But my preference is always to make some sort of sound. I mean, I love having a rock band, a four-piece, you know, a classic four-piece rock band. It's fantastic in its own right. But when I'm making a record, I'm always looking around the room thinking, oh, what else can I stick on this track? And hopefully there's a bit of discretion, but chances are there's a lot of stuff buried in there that might be recorded. It might be, you know, the mute button might be on, but it's still there somewhere. So I'm always playing with sounds and trying to see what I can get away with. It's probably a rare thing if a recording of mine is stripped down at all.
The imagery and the lyrics in here, you've certainly got a lot of things. If you're going to talk about Dracula, that invites little creepy noises, human cannonballs, shooting into space. The lyrics themselves invite that kind of, I want to say psychedelic, but it's not all psychedelic sounds. It's not those bendy 1968 noises. Like, what's that at the very beginning? You've got drums come in. So, you know, this is what makes me think, besides the presence of Colin Moulding, did that retroactively make you play this guitar lick more like it sounds like an Andrew Partridge lick? And this very straight drum intro with some, is that a heavy link chain? What is that percussion noise at the beginning?
Can you hear that?
Oh, there you go.
I was wearing these beads when I recorded the vocal, and I kept them in. These were beads that my mother made when I was a child, you know, sort of authentic hippie era love beads. And they're gorgeous. And a friend of my parents rang me up a few years ago and said, hey, you know, I've got these beads that your mother made, and would you like them? I thought, of course. And so she brought them to me, and I already had a set. So there's sort of this nearly identical set of love beads. So she was kind of, you know, a little cottage industry apparently at one point, cranking out these beautiful love beads. I mean, I only know of the two sets. it was very meaningful for me to have that in the song. That's what those are. Those are proper love beads, circa probably 1968 or something like that. I don't know. The drummer on the track is Michael Urbano, and I knew he's a huge XTC fan. And so when Colin said he would play on this track, I knew I had to ask Urbano if he would play drums as well. And he was quite thrilled at the chance. Although I don't know which, there are two versions of the recording, two different mixes. The original version that Colin sent me, which is the one on the CD, the one that ended up on the CD, I had a lot of drum machines going there along with Urbano's drum tracks. And I think I had taken a lot of his fills and just run them through a fuzz box or something like that and was trying to do some sort of scary monsters sounding thing with his drums. And he wasn't thrilled. And so he told me, he said, look, man, you know, that wasn't what I was intending with that drum track. And what have you done, baby? So we kind of, I don't say compromised, but he came up with a sort of a solution, which is he said, look, I'll send you another drum track. And he sent me a very straight rock kind of Ringo sounding thing, very 60s track. And I used an alternate take that Colin had sent me. And so it's really nice. The LP version, not radically different mix, but different enough for the freaks out there. Michael Urbano was much happier that I used that track, and I didn't touch it. I left it intact. You know, I don't think I edited one drop.
We'll play a couple measures of the single version then. Talk about your backing vocal technique here. I know you have three guest singers, two of which at least, Carla and Allison, you have written songs for. Laura Miyazaki, is it?
Yeah, Laura Miyazaki.
So is that somebody else you've written for? Or were these all three of these people in a room together? Let me ask that.
No.
Okay.
They weren't.
So this is people emailing things across the ocean.
I know Allison and Laura were both in the room individually with me at the time that we were recording. Carla may have done hers in Berlin. I mean, I've worked with everybody in the room, and I've worked with some. I guess Carla's the only one I work with over email. But when I go home to California, you know, Allison will come over, and we've done a couple albums together, so she'll come over and record. And Laura has visited here in Berlin, and we've done a few bits and pieces. Or when I'm in California again, she comes over. And she's a very shy singer. She's not a singer per se, but I do love her voice. And so when I feel like I have something that really suits her sound, I'll ask her to come around. And like I said, she's shy in a way as a singer. So it'll just be a little phrase, maybe a little bits and pieces for her to sing. Whereas obviously Allison and Carla are both proper singers out there in the big rugged world. So
are you typically, when you have backing vocalists, dictating, or are you saying, do something here, and then kind of just seeing if you like it or not?
I do tend to have specific parts in mind, especially with vocals.
Well, and on this chorus in particular, I mean, that having that low harmony come in there and then the echoing, you know, that's very, very distinctive. That kind of makes the song. So I was wondering if that was obviously not in the original conception, which was solo acoustic and guitar, right. Acoustic guitar and voice, but, you know, something that came as a unit out of your head. Or whether it was patched together from the works of others.
I'm pretty certain that the parts of that particular song vocally are mine. I probably have the original track somewhere with, you know, me going, in my little nasal way. I mean, it's funny because it's a very low part. So the fact that there are three women singing it, that all sort of on the very low end of their range, it's not, at least the harmony that's under the vocal, it's very low.
Yes, I saw you doing it on a live thing on YouTube. I'll point folks to, with Allison Seconds doing backing vocals against that. And that definitely sounds like that's scraping the bottom of what her larynx is capable of.
Yeah. I mean, we've done two albums together now where she's singing songs that I write, mostly songs that I'm writing specifically for her. And when we're working like that, we do play with her range. You know, she's always been a harmony singer. And so this has been her chance to mess around as a lead singer. And so we will, is this too low? Oh, I think I can do it. I think I can do it. You know, that kind of thing. We do push her range a little bit with High Noon. It's on the edge of uncomfortable, I think. So sorry, everybody.
Let's use that as a transition. The second song, Dust Beneath My Wings, that was originally written for her. And in fact, we could play little bits of all of them. I picked this song because I was looking for something to represent your kind of moody syntho stuff and had seen the version off of the 2014 Antronica.
Mm-hmm.
However, now that I've heard the 3-minute tease version, 2011, we have to include that one in full because that's, it's just objectively, even though it's a little bit in the same universe as High Noon, it's just classic this way. So let's play this one in full and then we can play the intro and the outro, at least of the Antronica version, so folks can hear the difference. But you said you wrote this initially for Allison, but I see her, the version for her, the recorded version is 2016, though?
Yeah.
Or am I?
It took forever, yeah.
Okay. So there's a pre-2011 demo for her floating around somewhere as well.
Yeah, there must be.
okay.
I don't remember if it was, did I write it while she and I were working on her first record, or maybe right after we'd finished the first record. I know I wrote it while I was living in England. I was in Cambridge.
Which was 2009, right? That the first one came out?
Yeah.
And was that one you produced, you played all the instruments, most of the instruments, you wrote all the songs, is that right? This kind of Svengali sort of thing? Is that what they call it?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of it, yeah. I think one of the joys for me of being a musician, you know, it's kind of my payment, I guess, is that I get to work with some wonderful players. And so I think on Allison's first record and second record, we have some friends of ours and some rock stars here and there, people showing up and just contributing wonderful things. But at the heart of it, it is probably mostly me just sitting there with a drum kit going, oh, look, I'm Ringo again, you know.
Dust beneath my wings, the pilot on autopilot sings, the intercom on the passengers too stoned to notice. Love is everywhere, he sings to the navigator's hair, he sings to the cumulus laid out for miles before him. Love, it's the reason we are here, whisper love in every your cosmic jar. I tried to tell you twice, once in the summer that was nice, and once in the winter on the ice as it was cracking. You seem to understand, you took off your told my head what it was lacking. It's love, it's the reason we exist, it's the lips inside the kiss, it's the Bible.
So that's the tight 3-minute, 5-second version. A lot of your songs, you know, Black Lemon Sauce, one of the ones we were looking at, Flying Spider, Milk Churn in the Morning, these psychedelic ones, I don't see having the great potential as being songs other artists would cover because they're so dependent on maybe if they're a particular kind of hippie band or something, but they seem very tied to your own voice. And I completely sympathize with that when I think about trying to write something for somebody else, you know, that is, I don't want to say generic enough, but transferable enough to another human being. So that's what this was in essence. Also, you don't seem to write love songs that often. I was trying to figure out, is this actually a love song or it's just a song that talks about love, but it's not really a love song?
I would say it's a song about love. Whether it's a romantic love song or not, it has genuine love in it. And you take that one out to the gig and you sit down at the piano and sing it for people, and people come up afterwards saying, oh, what's the one with love? Well, you know, and I think there's genuine sort of squishy ball of light of love in that song. And so it is a love song in that sense, but not necessarily romantic. Person meets person and says, oh, can I buy you a diamond ring, baby? You know, or whatever people say these days. They probably don't say that no more, do they?
I mean, what they're referring to there is obviously the chorus, which has some nice plays on the canon of the wide range of love songs out there. But then how do we get from or to the verses? Dust beneath my wings, the pilot on autopilot sings, the intercom on the passenger is too stoned to notice. Love is everywhere. He sings to the navigator's hair. He sings to the cumulus laid out for miles below him.
Obviously, I'm just looking for rhymes, you know. If it rhymes.
It's a nice, vivid little picture. It almost sets up as if this is a song within a song, that it's the love song, and then who is singing the love song? Well, some weird situation is setting this up.
I suppose the thing that I'm coming to terms with in my own writing and in my own life is I kind of live on two levels at once. I live in a world of symbols, and that's normal for me, very natural for me. And I forget sometimes that this is a very literal world. And so when I write things like that, I suppose that's fairly normal. If you place those lyrics next to the lyrics from High Noon, for example, they match up in some way, right? So stylistically, those are Anton songs, and they feel, High Noon and Dust Beneath My Wings feel straightforward to me, which is, of course, funny, I suppose, because they're probably not, lyrically at least.
Well, yeah, I could ask the same question about the chorus for High Noon, what that has to do with this sort of talking about a rock star Jesus figure and his tortured mother, and then High Noon, the sun reflected on its satellite. High Noon, has death affected you, your appetite? I'm not sure I understand this as a literal.
I am not sure I do either.
Sometimes the writer has a very clear picture in mind, but what actually drains out of that to become the lyrics is something much more obscure. And sometimes it's really just the words driving things. Which, are you in one of those camps?
I can pull a lot of abstract images together, sort of one after the next. I often, you know, it's my John Lennon technique. I'll often write with a television on. I'll sit there with the TV in front of me and probably with the sound down, but you've got images rolling past. There's another song on Magic Act called Milk Churn in the Morning that was written. It was inspired by Eurovision 2014, the Polish entry. You have to just Google that, trust me. But I was actually writing it, maybe it was the next day, while watching some Errol Flynn film in German with subtitles on or something. And with some, I think it was a Maybelline makeup commercial coming on in the middle. All of that somehow ends up as the lyric for Milk Churn in the Morning.
And see, I thought that was the most obviously English song on there with the talk of tea and things like just the whole atmosphere. So that's how far I missed that.
I think of that as an English song as well. I mean, I lived in England for years. And so I pictured that song as set in Cambridge, for example, and the plumber's coming around and you always offer the workman, you know, oh, do you like a cup of tea? Can I get a coffee? Sorry, Matt, I don't know how to do coffee. Do you want tea? No, I want coffee. All right, sorry, I'll just leave. So you know, Milk Churn is set in England, but it was written in Berlin. But anyway, back to the idea of God knows what. I hope that my songs, even when they're obtuse or obscure or not literally decipherable, I always hope there's a feeling, emotion that comes through. I think with Dust Beneath My Wings, there is the feeling of love. It's genuine love. I get that when I'm performing it, and I hope to give that off to an audience. And again, it's not a pickup line. It's not romantic love and necessarily. I mean, you know, what's the difference, I suppose? Maybe that's the point, really. is that in some scheme of things, love is love. High Noon is the same thing. High Noon, it's so rare that I can ever say to an audience, for example, this song is about blah, 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 without going on for 20 minutes and not making any sense. High Noon, I can say, oh, it's about love and acceptance, you know, love and forgiveness, simple things like that. And everyone nods their head and then you play the song and you move on to the next thing.
High Noon, the sun reflected on its satellite. So just if it doesn't ruin the magic of the line, translate that into what you just said.
I have no idea. I sincerely have no idea. And I hope this isn't disappointing for anybody that songs aren't always based on something real. Sometimes for me, it's a series of question marks. There's a quote from Brian Eno that I'm not remembering very well, but it's something along the lines of, it's the idea that you want questions raised rather than answers provided. And you want to be drawn in and intrigued. And I hope that with at least, you know, my better material, I can do that. I can pull people in and create the feeling that something is happening, that something is, and you don't know what it is. So with High Noon, it feels complete. The song, when I perform it or when I listen to the recording, it feels like a complete thought. It feels like a complete feeling somehow. And I couldn't even tell you why High Noon. I don't remember if there was something on television in front of me when I was scribbling it down. I'm sure I would have known if the film High Noon was playing, but it might just be vowel sounds. You know, I might just be sitting there with the guitar going,
Is there a connection between the fact you've got all this Dracula imagery in the second part of the song? And so that's night, but yet the chorus is High Noon. Like, is that contrast intentional or is that merely the drift of the mind?
But I was thinking of Son of Dracula, which is a film that Ringo Starr was in, you know, so.
Okay.
So it's actually more filmic than vampiric, I guess. Now we're getting into the dark secrets of the song.
Whenever you get into something like just the catchiness of the chorus and the reason that it is catchy, and I realize we're supposed to be talking about the second song now, but we can apply this across the board, is because it connotes your dredging some trick in the book from whether it's for, I think when I played this on Spotify, it recommended XTC's The Loving right after this, which in turn is, you know, a complete Beatles influence sort of thing. So you go into these modes in music because you're using traditional forms where it brings up some sort of cultural, it very much goes with what you're talking about, the image of High Noon or the image of Son of Dracula, these things from movies, from TV, so that they have a certain feeling as a media thing that has kind of pulled you along at some point, maybe in fact when you were too young to rebel against it or something like that. So that's why we get caught up with music in the first place, is because we fall across this stuff when we're 8 years old or however old we were. So that something about having a catchy chorus, which is not there so much. I mean, of course, there's when we get to the chorus of the mellow version of Dust Beneath My Wings, there's a certain torch song sort of light theme that's being evoked there too, but it's not as strong. It's not as direct as the big old chorus. So there's got to be some effect from that on how the lyrics are interpreted, that it's this idiosyncratic, unique string of words, but yet it's being put in this somewhat traditional. I mean, especially you've got like the crazy Colin Moulding bass lines that are very unexpected in ways that I would expect to hear from Colin Moulding. Those, I assume, came out of his brain. You said you just got him in there and.
Yeah, I didn't tell him. I didn't say, oh, can you play these notes, please, sir? We let Colin Moulding be Colin Moulding, don't we? That was a thrill, I can tell you. As far as the chorus, we want that payoff, don't you? You want that glorious pop pleasure feeling that comes from a catchy chorus. And if you set it up right, I don't think it always matters what you're saying. I don't know that it matters what the words are.
Well, that's why some of the best that I kind of have to distinguish between power pop bands, you know, I like both sides, but that some of them have just the dumbest possible lyrics and some of them are the deepest stuff and it almost doesn't matter. It has almost the same appeal.
The genre of power pop seems, I don't know. I shouldn't say anything. I don't understand it. You know, it's, we're all here, aren't we? I'll tell you the darkest secret of all though with High Noon, the chorus, it's the same chords as Louie Louie.
There you go.
And I really kept trying to unwrite that. I kept trying to find a fourth chord or change the third chord to take it away from that progression. But it's just the 1-4-5.
It's got its own rhythm, and the bass by itself puts it into a different world there.
Yeah, yeah. Colin, when he sent me the second version of his bass track, he came up with a different tone. He used the same Epiphone bass, but he played it with a different tone. He described that as his Archie's tone. He says, oh, yeah, it's kind of, I'm picturing kind of sugar, sugar type of bass sound here. And then he, on the LP version, he also sent a piano track, which he described as his Velvet Underground piano. So it's, how privileged must I be to have Colin Moulding sending me an Archie's bass track and a Velvet's piano track for the same song.
Oh, so that little dissonant thing that comes in and goes out, that dang, 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 that's his invention?
Yep, yep, yep.
All right. See, I thought, I saw that as typical Anton putting in the little flourishes. All right. So you're just on the same page.
I said to him, I said, does it need another hook? Does it need another little thing, you know? And he said, well, you know, so he sent me that. So that was great. That was a great little moment.
Well, speaking of that, with Dust Beneath My Wings off the Allison version, You added an extra thing at the end. Oh, love, hello. Like that's this extra thing that's the refrain. That's not in any of the other versions. Was it something that just didn't come out until, you know, 4 years after the song is written here? That
there's something in the original version, in the 3 minute tease version, that's along those lines at the end of the song as it's fading out. There's some sort of little, you know, harmonized bit. And so the Allison version just took that and a little bit further, I suppose.
I guess I was distracted by the, is that a theremin or musical saw or a synth equivalent doing that stuff at the end of?
Yeah, that's a synth on the three minute tease version. Yeah. It's funny. It's a software synth and it was a demo. And you know, often with demo products, the audio will cut out until you actually pay
sure.
the full price. And so I believe that I was just using the demo version, which I haven't listened to it in a while, but I think it cuts out at various points, that little synth. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's play just the beginning of the Antronica version. Just so this is the version that I can see, you know, you playing on piano at a gig and people being all, it's nicer this way. Let's say that.
I think people respond very emotionally to it. It's a very emotional song. I'm a very emotional person. People just don't know this.
And then the other crazy thing about this version was the end. That what made you decide, I think this needs to have a banjo. I think this needs to...
That's John from the band Stornoway, and he'd sent me that banjo track for the 3 minute tease version. But when Andy, our bass player, mixed, he did the mix of Dust, and he kept John's cello in there. Gorgeous cello. I still can't believe that cello part. He kept John's cello, but he didn't go for the banjo track. And I love the banjo. So I just wanted to make sure that banjo got used. And so it got stuck on the Antronica version. Had to go somewhere. It's too good. So that's John's idea. He sent me a cello and said, oh, and I've done a banjo as well. And you think, well, fair enough.
So I can understand if you wrote this, you know, for somebody else's album, then wanting to go back and do your own version and maybe do it a little more mellow, get a little more of the feeling out of it. It was actually only today that I realized that I had not listened to the 3 Minute Tease albums, that I just had missed that little bit. I had read in your bio, I played with the two guys from the Egyptians, but I like, okay, I guess I'm not sure which songs that's on exactly because I'm just looking on Spotify at this stuff. And then I hear this version. How did you get them to play with you? People wanted to know that secret. You know, what are the rhythm sections that you probably worshipped since your...
Certainly, since 1986, I think. I mean, it's a bit of a long, convoluted story. The short version is that I'd met them in San Francisco at an Egyptians gig years earlier, and now I'm living in Cambridge, which is, of course, where the Soft Boys originally formed. And Kimberly from the Soft Boys is still in Cambridge, and I'd see him sometimes, and I think Morris would play with Kim sometimes. So I'd run into Morris at gigs, and meanwhile, somehow had gotten in touch with Andy and said, hey, you're just one of my favorite bass players. Would you ever be up for playing on a track? And he said, yeah, you know, sure. And so I met Andy. We ended up doing a gig in London before we did any recordings. So that was kind of cool. So we'd done a gig, and then he started playing on a few recordings. And the same thing kind of was happening with Morris. I did a gig in Swindon with Morris the week before we ended up in Berlin together at the same time. And I said, well, we've got to record something, don't we? And in fact, the room I'm sitting in, you know, the apartment I'm living in is on the same street that the studio was where Morris and I first recorded. So yeah, we ended up in Berlin and we started recording together and gigging and recording, and I'm gigging and recording with Andy. And at some point I said to one of them, I said, look, would you want to play with, I said, probably said to Morris, would you want to play with Andy? And he says, yeah, that's fine. And I said, Andy, would you want to play with Morris again? He says, yeah, that'd be great. And it was simple like that. I think 3 Minute Tease, in however many years we were together, we had maybe one or two rehearsals, but we just booked a gig and said, all right, that's it. We'll start playing. And yeah, once we started playing, had done a few gigs, we realized that the recordings that I'd been doing with each of them, why don't we do something proper? Let's do a real album. So from that point, we kind of zeroed in on making the first record. And,
well, that's very inspiring. It makes me want to go and like, I'll put the cars back together myself whatever, pick your favorite 80s or 90s band, all the ex-members of various things.
I do not take it for granted that I was in a band with Andy and Morris for a few years. I mean, it was an amazing experience. And we all know if you're a fan of their work, then you're a fan of their work. You know who they are and you know what they do, what they sound like, but they're also lovely people as well. Just a great experience. I loved making those two records.
So anything else about this Antronica version, what you were trying to do? What, you've got an extra whole minute in here. Was that just so you could relax a little bit, put this kind of electronic hissing thing at the beginning? And, you know, it's still a fairly simple arrangement. Just you playing, what is that, a synth Rhodes or something?
That's my Wurlitzer. I've got an old Wurlitzer.
Okay, the Wurlitzer.
You know, again, I think that was meant to be the Allison recording.
Oh, okay. That she was going to sing directly over this.
Yeah. It took years to finally get it together so we could do that song. So this was originally, this version was meant for her to sing. So, you know, Allison's a huge Wurlitzer fan. Both of the records I've done with her are just loaded with Wurlitzer. Who doesn't love the Wurlitzer, right? So yeah, it was, you know, hey Al, I've done a version of Dust Beneath My Wings for you to sing. It's got Wurly on it, so come on over. And we just couldn't get it together for years.
Well, we should then play the very beginning, at least, of the 2016 version, just so we can get the contrast.
Intercom on the passengers, too stoned to notice. Love is everywhere.
So yeah, it sounds like you leaned on the production values a little bit on this final one.
Although, you know, I can't remember, but I think the Wurlitzer on the Allison version, it's just a little solo-y thing at the end or something.
It's in there. It's peeking out. There's a lot of other stuff, you know, not to mention just her big vocal cluster that
right.
dominates everything very obviously in a way that you did not mix yourself that loud. Well, let's make the transition to the third song here, In the Village of the Apple Sun, on the title track of the album from 2006. Again, I was referring to this. You had called this your Sgt. Pepper's. Am I correct in interpreting that that's because it was the jump in style from the stuff before that to the stuff after that was something very definitive?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I want to be delicate about this, but I was definitely enjoying A Summer of Love musically and otherwise. And it was undeniably coming out in the music I was making and in the music I was listening to. One of the things that crystallized the idea for me of doing Village of the Apple Sun was the album I made with the Bevis Frond. I'd gone to England to work with them, and, you know, these guys are psychedelic warlords, and I thought they were going to dose me with LSD and leave me in a ditch for 3 weeks and have some God knows what, you know, I'd be there with the cows while the album got made for me. But in fact, the album I made with them was incredibly straightforward. We were just focused, just got down to it. We did 12 rhythm tracks in one day, and every day was sort of production line of overdubs and so forth and mixing, and just so straightforward. And I really loved the record I did with those guys, but I wish it was a little bit weirder. I wish we had one extra day of mixing just to make it weird.
Yeah, it sounds a little more, you know, 1996 or 1998 alternative rock rather than this Summer of Love thing for that album.
Right. I mean, I think there's one song called Sylvia something, which is a pretty, that was leading up to the Village of the Apple Sun experience. But yeah, by the time I was ready to make Village of the Apple Sun, I was ready, if that makes any sense. Everything was needing reflection, you know. There were a lot of kaleidoscopes in the air.
All right, well, that's a good preparation.
In the Village of the Apple Sun, where the bees won't sting just anyone, all the children to their mothers run, as the swan floats on the river down. In the village of the afternoon, as the apple falls beneath the moon, all the garden snakes appear too soon, when the swan fluffs up its feathers. Suddenly, in the village when the sun goes down, all the apple seeds return to ground. All the children sleep despite the sound of the earth so quickly turning. Oh, in the village of the apple stars, I will be with you wherever you are. Like a centipede in a candy jar, like a swan on every river. Oh.
So deceptively simple. We're just going to start acoustic guitar and voice, and the lyrics are a little psychedelic. But then I really like that there's a lot of movement in this song, that that a lot of your other songs, there's movement, but it is kind of subtle. And in fact, I was on the recent album, you know, when I was in the car and playing it to my kids and things, you know, a song like Flying Spider or something, I'm like, the first impression is it's kind of just repeating the same thing a lot. Like they get into these raga modes or something, you know, where you're repeating, you get a gesture out there. And to figure out like, well, why is the song as long as it is requires actually ignoring the vocals and focusing on the background, because like there's a lot of stuff shifting around there. Like that's what's actually going on in the song. But this one, there's just nothing subtle about that. There's movement. I don't know if this is the day in the life sort of. That's kind of the position of this on the record near the end. It's not quite the end, but
if I were to reissue this record, and I would really like to, actually, I would trim the record a little bit and make that the final track. There's a lot of movement. I mean, there was a lot of movement in my life at the time, a lot of movement in my mind, man. Now, it's funny because this song, it's actually far more possible to talk about it very literally, what went into the lyrics. I mean, again, I don't have it in front of me. I don't remember it that well, but the lyrics are describing my first day ever in Oxford, England. And in Oxford is where Lewis Carroll did his thing, and Tolkien, they all kind of went there to groove a little bit, you know, and it makes perfect sense. So I was there with my girlfriend at the time, and we were walking along the river. A friend that we just met, she was there to kind of try to keep us awake through our jet lag. So she said, let's go out for a walk. So we're walking along the Isis River in the afternoon, and just a beautiful day, late September, and people on bicycles going by with their little bells and dogs and butterflies and all the stuff you want, and people in boats, you know, going past you down the river. And at some point, we heard this incredible roar from across the way, across the river in this meadow. There's just didn't understand what's happening. And all of a sudden, it's, you see this apple sun, so I call it, but it's a big red hot air balloon taking off from this meadow. And in our jet-lagged state, with this glorious, call it a late summer day, everything was very psychedelic. And seeing that red hot air balloon just taking off out of this meadow out of nowhere, it was fantastic. So the lyrics are a bit more literal, which is kind of ironic in a way for such a tripped out experience. The music kind of, it describes, the music is there to describe a multidimensional experience, man.
So say something about the particular arrangement choices here. I mean, throwing in recorder and throwing in, is it more, now things have to get huge, and then kind of deciding from there, like, well, what do I have at my disposal? Or did you go into this with, I need to have some backwards guitar in there from, you know, were some of the sounds the initial ideas, or was just the song is down and it just during the recording process is when all this stuff sprouts up?
In this case, it was a bit more, maybe a bit more linear on my part. I said, well, you know, it's going to start kind of quiet, it's going to get bigger, but I didn't have a lot of thought as to how this is going to happen. This song is a really nice. There's a lot of collaboration on this one. Sharon Krause is playing, I think she's playing penny whistle on this one. And I just met her, I think it was that day, and said, she lived in Oxford at the time, but I actually met her in California. I had met her when I was recording it and said, hey, do you want to be on this track? She said, yeah, sure. So she just improvised the penny whistle that you hear there. Fantastic, you know, really nice. And I had some other friends. My friend Jamie's playing violin on there, but the really mad stuff is Alan Strawbridge from the band Schnauzer. He did the mix of the song, which is basically, you know, the song explodes. I think the explosion, there's two fuzz bass tracks from Gabriel Nelson, but Alan, when he mixed it, I don't know what he did to my track, but it really does just explode. So that song, that's a nice one for me because it's everybody's involvement. All the different people playing on that record really brought it to life, and they're doing things that I could have never done or would have never thought to do. So whether it's the really gentle intro of Sharon Krause's penny whistle or, you know, Alan sort of blowing up the fuzz basses and everything, that's a very, very favorite recording of mine.
So what about this choir here? Is that digital choir, or there sounds like there's actual singing over it at some point.
I think I had played a sampled choir on a Kurzweil keyboard or something. And when I sent it to Alan for mixing, he kind of boosted that with his own singing. So he augmented it with the vocals. Beautiful touch. And I remember saying, oh, I really like the Wurlitzer piano you added there. He says, oh, that wasn't me, man. That was on your track. So I was like, oh, that's me. Thank you. Thank you very much. Alan, he deserves a lot of credit for making that song come to life the way it does.
And is that pretty exceptional for you that you're outsourcing your mixing? It sounded like your output is so heavy. I would be surprised if financially it would make sense that to have somebody else mix most of it. What is your approach like on the High Noon CD or the Bandcamp only one before that?
Yeah, I do most mixing myself. And something like the Village of the Apple Sun track, I mean, that was ages ago, but something like that was very easy. I was recording on an old Roland hard disk recorder, and Alan uses the same machine, so I just sent him the files via carrier duck or something. So it doesn't cost nobody nothing kind of thing, a friend doing a friend a favor kind of situation. I'm working with this French band right now called Salt, and done the record at Abbey Road Studio 2, and then we most recently were in Paris at a place called Ferber. Beautiful studios, right? These, incredible places. And I'm just thinking, can I just have $50, please? Just, I'm so used to making records kind of by myself, even with the involvement of a lot of people. Something like Magic Act still happened a lot by myself. I'm in this room and people are emailing me tracks. So yeah, doing the mixing at home. I'm lucky that I have help. Sometimes I send something to Andy Metcalf and say, hey, can you listen to this mix for me? Or Eric Broyhill, who used to do mastering and mixing and tracking for me over the years. So, people whose ears I trust. But otherwise, yeah, it's just kind of me. I mean, I'd love to be back in a big studio doing this stuff. But at the same time, when you're home and you can just work on it forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
I found the ideal, if I can get away with it, is if, for a while, I'd mix it myself, but then if I was using Cubase, then I could take it in the studio that they were using Nuendo, and it was, you could, it's the same manufacturer, so you could import my exact mixing track and then just tweak it from there. So like, okay, make the drums actually sound good. Yes. Do the stuff, the EQ stuff that I don't really have the technical expertise to do, but I know exactly how I want the 14 vocal parts in relation to each other. And if I had to tell you or just let you do it on your own, I would not be happy.
Sometimes it's the mess that we make. It's the sort of accidental way that we work. You think, well, that's the sound. It might not be up to standards in a way, but it's still the sound you want or the sound you like. And if you, it can be tricky to translate that to people who say, well, no, let's bring it up to spec. You think, no, keep it kind of low, man. So
do you at least get it mastered professionally?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the hard thing. Like, I never know exactly how much bass to put on thing, not the bass instrument, but the bass end of the spectrum.
Right.
It's just, I have not put in the time to, it just takes too much work. I've gone through that before of like putting on CDs and comparing it to try to get the exact same mastering profile, and best to just send it to somebody who does that all day.
Yeah. And the guy that mastered Magic Act and the Allison record, I can send him my mixes before we're ready to master, and he'll give me input. He'll say, I'd pull the bass down a little bit, bring the kick drum up. The vocals are a little bit bright. So he'll help me with the mixes before it's time to actually do the mastering. And again, I feel very, very fortunate. I've got kind of a small army of people that I've worked with who help me with advice, so I can do my work from this little room and still get decent results,
Well, with that said, we wanted to just leave people with one more song from the new album, from Magic Act. I had picked Swindon. If that one works for you, we could pick anything you want.
Sure.
So say a little about where this track came from.
Well, of course, Swindon is known to many of us as the home of XTC.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to pay a little tribute.
Is it a dreary industrial town? That's kind of what I thought based on the XTC lore.
Sure. Yeah. It's not a glamorous place. Let's say that, but I play there probably twice a year. I'm there fairly often, and Old Town is lovely. I love the Old Town in Swindon. So, I'll say that.
All right. So it's not the Northern Indiana of England. Maybe that doesn't mean as much to you.
Yeah. I mean, Swindon isn't Slough. Let's just say that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really feel like we're getting what insight can be got into the crazy stuff you do.
Yeah. Good luck to everybody, right?
Rain coming down in baskets. Vampires asleep in caskets. I've got the secret word in my head. Lamaprazole each morning. dreams that spell no warning. Lips locked in pleasure, say thy name. Swindon, 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 Swindon. I'd like to reach inside you, spin round your roads and ride you. Lift up your skirt, you're beautiful. Swindon, your Billy Piper needs you. Ask Jasper Ford to read you. Diana Doors, where are you now? Swindon, Swindon, Swindon. I'd like to reach inside you, spin round your rose and ride you. Lift up your skirt, you're beautiful. Swindon, give me back the bread I lent ya. The juice of orange is sweet Valencia. That wasn't what I meant, I am, I said.
Well, thanks so much to Anton Barbeau. You can learn more about him at antonbarbeau.com. And thanks to my previous guest, Carla Kane of the Corner Laughers, for putting me in touch with him. I should mention that she has a solo album coming out in October. It's already available for pre-order. You can hear one of the tracks at cornerlaughers.com. Now, if this episode sounded slightly different than the previous ones, it's because for the first time, I handed the reins in terms of incorporating the actual songs and clips of songs to another former guest from this show, Tyler Hislop, who has been my longtime editor. I could not do the show without his assistance, and I would really like to pay him more. And that is why I'm asking you to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic and make a contribution, however small. All right, I just announced the upcoming episodes on the last episode. I'm not going to do that again here. I'm going to keep trying to put these things out one per week or so. Keep your eyes glued to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or subscribe to me on iTunes or Stitcher. And I should mention that we are part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. So you can see announcements of upcoming episodes for all these podcasts at partiallyexaminedlife.com/upcoming. All right. I hope you are as inspired by Anton as I was to really open up your imagination. Get out there. Don't wait for anybody's permission. Don't let the fact that you have to set up your equipment or whatever other mental blocks are keeping you from recording things, from writing things, from getting out there and making some music. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.
She's everything. She's just a girl.